And we're going to continue our discussion with Michael Schratt about, of course, mysterious aircraft. Don't forget his contest. He's giving away $1,000 if you can get his crossword puzzle right. We've got that link for you at coasttocoastam.com. We're going to take your calls when we come back with him as well and finish up talking about Leonard Stringfield's UFO cases and just what those might have been. And welcome back to Coast. Michael Schratt with us. We'll get to your calls as well this hour. Michael, I'm beginning to see a pattern here with these objects, these triangular-shaped objects, that many of these reports that have come in as UFOs could very well be our own stuff.
No question about it, George. I think you're hitting the nail on the head.
Maybe that's a good thing sometimes. Not to say that there aren't ETs or extraterrestrials or UFOs, but... You know, I think, as you said, we have to look home very first and foremost. You're talking about the Leonard Stringfield files that he turned over to MUFON, I guess, right?
Correct. Yes, I interviewed a gentleman who interviewed a Marine who claims in December of 1963 he boarded an aircraft with blacked-out windows, and they flew between 2.5 or to 3 hours from Cherry Point, North Carolina. He was never told where they landed, where it was. So when they got out of the plane, they walked into an undisclosed location, perhaps a hangar, perhaps just a larger building. And I'll set the scene for you here.
Sure.
What he saw when he looked inside this hangar was a 40-foot diameter dish-shaped craft, kind of hamburger-shaped. It had elliptical windows going around the outer circumference, 40 feet in diameter, 15 feet high. It had a polished chrome silver aluminum finish. There was a one-inch lip between the exterior of the craft and the beginning of the opaque blacked-out windows, so you couldn't see through these windows. Now, when he saw this thing for the first time, it was propped up on these 6x6 wooden beams, and somehow they had constructed a series of scaffolding around this so that these white lab coat technicians could walk around this thing at eye level and look at this and go under it. So he was there. There was a white circle painted on the concrete floor of this hangar, and you were not allowed to breach that circle for fear of being shot by this guy. There were other people there as well, but he was ordered to basically guard this saucer for a period of 2 weeks. He also said that they tried diamond tip drills to breach the hull of this craft. Couldn't do it. They put one drill right at that ledge point where the craft meets the window itself. That didn't work. And they also tried a very high-powered laser, George. This is 1963, so it's
Jeez.
Kind of arcane technology at that time. And the size of the power for this laser was an 18-wheeler tractor-trailer truck that pulled up beside. And there was two very thick electrical cables that went to this laser. And when they... put the laser on the exterior of the craft, not only did it not make any kind of soot or any kind of damage to the craft, it actually bounced off and hit a ceiling tile and somehow damaged the ceiling tile. That exact event was later shown up in the movie Hangar 18. That's where that came from.
I love it. Great stories. Now, you wouldn't... Go ahead.
The last day he was there, they were packing it up, putting it on an 18-wheeler tractor trailer, putting a tarp on top of it, and then chains on the tarp, and it was moved to the next location. So it looks, George, like they don't keep these craft at any one location for any length of time. They keep moving it from place to place so you can't track it down.
That's interesting.
Here's where the story gets weird, because at one of these times, he was alone there, and George, he took a photograph of this thing.
Where is it?
With his small Minox camera. He took a photograph of it. Somewhere around 86, there was a flood, and the photo disappeared.
Oh.
We were that close, George. We were
that would have been amazing. Do the Russians or the Chinese possess this kind of technology?
I don't know, George, but you got to think. We've got things, absolutely, after World War II, we know for a fact that a number of British intelligence reports were put together in something called the Dawson Report that included a lot of stealth technology from the Third Reich that was handed over after the Kennedy assassination to the United States government in Washington, D.C. Now, some of that has never been even talked about. What are in those files? So if we had them, you know the Russians have it too.
Absolutely. Now, we were talking about Ben Rich and the 1990s at Skunk Works. Here we are some 20-some years later. What kind of technology or craft do you think we have today, Michael?
Oh, that's a really good question. That's a very good question. And what I want to discuss is I don't want anyone to think that I don't think there is a hypersonic aircraft out there. I absolutely do think, for sure. One thing I want to highlight is a statement made by ex-CIA Director Richard Helms. Here's what he said, quote, "The national security demands that we keep supplying new generations of surveillance aircraft to our policymakers. There is no way to replace the vital data provided by piloted airplanes. Satellites lack the flexibility and the immediacy that only a spy plane like the U-2 can provide. No president or intelligence agency should have to operate with only one eye open in such an uncertain and dangerous world." So right there, George, is the Rosetta Stone, I believe, for a manned or unmanned multi-Mach supersonic reconnaissance or intelligence gathering aircraft. Right there, that's the Rosetta Stone right there. He's saying that we can't rely on satellites alone. We have to keep putting in new generations of surveillance aircraft. The U-2 can't be anywhere in the world in less than 2 hours. It's too slow. So by default, we have to have something supersonic.
President Trump is recommending a space force. Mm-hmm. I have a feeling we already have one. What do you think?
I think we already have one, George, and this is borne out by the March 6, 2006 Aviation Week Space Technology article written by Bill Scott. In a nutshell, try to break this down real quick. It appears, George, that after the Challenger explosion on January 28, 1986, the United States Air Force and the Department of Defense lost, George, what they called, actual term that they use, quote, their assured access to space. They were out of business. Because at least 78% of shuttle payloads are NRO Keyhole spy satellites, George. Not civilian, but actually military spy satellites. So a desperate cry went out to the contractors, including Lockheed Rockwell, McDonnell Douglas, and Boeing, to design and procure a two-stage-to-orbit space plane that could be anywhere in the world in less than 2 hours, exactly what Richard Helms is talking about, for the purpose of launching a small satellite into a low Earth orbit or launching depleted uranium rods from God, George. That's what they're looking at here.
Let's take some calls here for you, Michael.
Go right ahead.
They're lining up. Let's go to Anthony in the Mojave, California. Anthony, thanks for calling. Go ahead.
Hi, thank you. As I told the screener, I live out by Edwards, and I'm always watching them. And I said, take your pick, invisibility, teleportation of B-52s and things like, on that order. F-35 programs they practiced directly over where I live did very strange things. The F-35 had a weird habit of, when it was doing its most elaborate kind of maneuvers, the jet engines sounded like they're coming through speakers.
Jeez. bet you see it all out there. Huh?
It stopped in midair like it had a set of brakes, and you rotate around an axis to whatever position on that compass it wanted to go and take off. I saw two do it on a collision course, and they just rotated away, and you could have blew each other a kiss. Seen a friend of mine said, "Oh, I saw your invisibility on a B-1. This guy lives 5 miles south of me. He says B-1. Went climbing up over my backyard and then just disappeared. I go, was it about 4 o'clock? And he goes, yeah. I go, he came over to my place.
You saw it.
I saw him reappear at the exact same time he saw it disappear. So, yeah, they do some. And the first one I saw was an F-15, two F-15s messing around with the NASA B-52. And one would disappear. Before my binoculars, anyway. I have big binoculars pointed.
You got to get a camera out there, Anthony, and take some pictures. That would be cool. We got to get more people to get information and feed it to you, Michael. Do you have an email address you give out?
Oh, sure. And it's on my crossword puzzle. I'm also offering, George, another $1,000 cash prize for anyone who can solve my B-2 stealth bomber crossword puzzle as well. So you got opportunity to win $2,000 cash by this Sunday at 11:59 p.m.
Boy, you want those Skunk Works employees to come out, don't you? How come you don't have a website?
Because this is a crusade for me. It's definitely not about the money. It's about the crusade. Partially, you know, I think we have a right to know to a certain degree, as long as we're not breaching security. Even better, that there should be a sunset law to another number of these programs. They're 50 years old. It's not going to represent any national security threat if we declassify some of these. So that's what I'm after. I really think we have a need to know. In fact, we're paying for these things. And as you know, George, the Air Force does not own the airplanes. They don't own the runways, the hangars, the airplanes, the facilities, the payroll. It is paid for and owned by the American taxpayer.
That's right.
The Air Force is nothing more than a temporary custodian of those assets. We are the owner, George. We are the owner.
When you have been doing this, and you've been doing it for years, have you ever been threatened or told to keep quiet?
No, because I'm providing a public service, George. I'm providing a public service. And they don't care what you know. They care what you can prove. That's how it works.
And they probably think, well, he can't prove it, so let him do his thing.
Sure. You know, but I'm providing everything from documented public sources. I haven't breached security. I've just interviewed engineers, pilots, people who worked on the programs, put the pieces together from eyewitness testimony. There is a black world out there. There is a classified landscape that is decades beyond what anything you'd see at your local air show. It does exist. It is real.
Michael, let me ask you this, only because it's my responsibility, but I got an email from someone who said, how do we know Michael is not a government plant and he's doing this to kind of leak us information and to get us known about what's going on?
I wish I was that important, George. I really
I had to ask you that.
No, I'm not a government agency. It would be great if it was that important and it was that high up on the chain, but I'm not, George.
All right.
Just small fries.
Let's go to Dan in York, Pennsylvania now. Hi, Daniel. Go ahead.
Hey, how you doing, Michael? Dan.
Hi. Hey, Dan. How are you?
Hey, Danny.
Pleased to speak to you. I had the pleasure to actually know Michael. Him and I have done some research together over the years, and I can guarantee you he's not a government-paid worker.
Okay.
Michael and I had the opportunity to spend time working on the TR-3B Flying Triangle research with Edgar Fouchet while he was alive. We used to talk to him on UVU, right on video, and Ed would talk about the electrochromatic panels, as Michael had spoke about, that would provide the sky, what would be on the top side of the craft, and the sky on the underside of the belly of the triangle, which has been one of the things that has been seen through a number of these sightings. I believe there are several different types of triangles, but I just wanted to throw that out there. Ed was a whistleblower on the TR-3B back in the mid-90s. He spoke of metamaterials, quasi-crystals, and the electrochromatic panels far before anybody else ever even had mentioned anything about this technology.
Go ahead, Michael.
Yep, well, not only that, Dan, as you remember, Ed also provided us with that illustration that he put together as well. I asked him if he would draw an illustration of what, and he actually followed through with what he said he was going to do. We have that on file as well.
What was the Monique O'Driscoll sighting? Can you tell us what that was, Michael?
That's a great sighting, George. That's an absolutely great sighting. So this is 1983. Monique O'Driscoll is driving from Kent, New York, after a dinner engagement. Her daughter is with her, also named Monique. Her daughter actually saw the craft first. It was kind of a white light, and then it started getting closer and closer to their car. And then this thing basically stopped at a place called White Pond in New York, and it flew over their car, and it caused static on the radio, so there was electromagnetic disturbance. As it parked itself over the frozen lake, it made a 180-degree flat turn and started flashing these multicolored lights, and you could see the reflection on the ice below. So the reds would go off, the blues would go off, the greens would go off, the yellows would go off. But, George, it wasn't haphazard. It was in sequence. There was a plan to it. There was an intelligence behind it. She also said that she could see tubes, pipes, and cylinders on the bottom of it, George. And then she said that she could see what looked like HVAC vents on the bottom of this craft as well. Like these industrial vents are great work on the bottom of the craft. So I just asked the question, are we looking at an alien spacecraft here? These things make electrical humming noise. They make an electromagnetic disturbance. Mm-hmm. They have multicolored flashing lights. They have vents on the bottom. They have pipes and cylinders on the bottom. Something's going on here. Someone's trying to sell us a bill of goods, George. And instead of me just telling you, let me hit you with what Monique said herself. So
sure.
This is March 17th, 1983. Her sighting took place February 26th, 1983. This is what she said, quote, something that size, if it had been an airplane, it would shake your windows out. I could see the underbelly part. It's solid. It had metal type work like cross beams and tubular things hanging down here and there. I was so close, I could have thrown a ball and hit it. So here's her direct description. Now, that's not the only one. There's multiple other eyewitnesses who describe the same tubes, pipes, and cylinders, just like the Taconic State Parkway, just like the Southern Illinois Flying Triangle, even the Phoenix Lights craft. People reported the same tubes, pipes, and cylinders, George.
What's the propulsion for these, Michael?
I believe, George, that a case in 1985 in Madison, Wisconsin, where a black triangle flew over this gentleman, and he said that the bottom of it, George, looked like the back of a refrigerator with these condensation pipes that ran back and forth.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been thinking, George, what is the purpose of these pipes? There must be a reason for them. I'm thinking, George, that it is a liquid nitrogen cooling agent to turn the whole bottom of it into a superconductor. Because they only become conductive when they're super chilled down to minus 274 degrees Kelvin, turning the whole thing into a superconductor, which allows this thing to levitate.
Is it a magnet?
It might be some type of a composite material, and this is exactly the right time frame as well. So I think it all adds up. We're looking at a man-made technology. We're not looking at an alien craft in this particular case.
And that was 35 years ago.
Yeah, I know.
Eric, truck driving in Indiana. Hello, Eric.
George! This is Eric, the mind control guy. How's everybody doing tonight?
My ears, Eric, my ears.
I try to tone the volume down a little bit. Anyway, the question I have is these folks that work at, you know, Area 51, Site 4, Dulce, Hangar 18, and the lesser known ones, and the ones that fly all those super ultra unconventional aircraft, how do these guys even get those jobs? It's not like you can go apply for it.
Maybe they go and get them. What do you think, Michael?
Well, if you're a defense contractor and you're really good at your job, they'll call you. You don't have to come to them.
They know who you are.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. They know how to do it.
I mean, it's like our business. You know, when you do your job and do it well, people find you.
Sure. Absolutely. Absolutely.
They do it again. Michael, we're going to take a quick break and come back with final phone calls for you. Michael Schrad, our special guest. Get up to our website, coasttocoastam.com, and give it a try. Participate in his couple crossword puzzles. He's giving out some prizes if you can get it right. Now, of course, he's a smart guy. He's looking for insiders, probably from Skunk Works, because only you folks would know the answer to some of those questions. So give it a try, and don't forget to also like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, and we shall be back with more in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, our final segment with Michael Schrat as we talk about our mysterious aircraft. And truly mysterious indeed. Let's talk another case. Tell me about the United Flight 934 encounter, Michael. What was that?
Okay, sure. No problem, George. No problem. This came from an article written by Bill Scott, and the date over here, this is the date right here, George, August 24th, 1992. This is Aviation Week Space Technology, and what they describe is the actual United Flight 934, August 5th, 1992, 747 LAX to London, near George Air Force Base, California at 1:45 p.m. They were basically on a magnetic heading of 40 degrees to London, passing near the Daggett VOR. So it's a 747, and both the pilot and co-pilot, George, saw this, what they described as a, quote, forward-looking section of an SR-71 with twin-canted vertical stabilizers passed between 500 and 1,000 feet directly below their aircraft. So they got a view of the top. This was also confirmed by United Airlines, their internal newsletter. It was also reported in that newsletter as well. They both saw it. They said it was traveling about three times their cruise speed, seen directly below them, and it was kind of a lifting body configuration with that forward chine section of an SR-71. To this day, George, this sighting has never been fully explained.
Wow. I mean, those are amazing stories. Truly amazing.
Yep, they're documented. They're documented. Now, other thing to consider, George, is do you know the cost of the F-22, George? The F-22 Raptor.
Oh, gosh, I would just guess, but I would say it's into the billions.
Well, according to CNN report, okay, this is CNN September 24th, 2014. Here's what they had to say. The problem-plagued F-22 Raptor took part in its first combat mission Monday night, hitting ISIS targets in Syria. The price tag for those jets, which were in development for decades, is a staggering $412 million each. Triple, George, its expected cost, according to the GAO. $412 million per aircraft, George? That's more than the original cost of the B-2 bomber. How does the fighter cost more than a bomber, George? Something strange indeed. I mean, obviously, the money's, you know, it's much more expensive now, but $412 million is something being filtered or siphoned off to another project. It's something that we should consider as well. Even the F-35, George, it is so expensive that it has its own name. They call it the plane that broke the Pentagon's back. According to 60 Minutes, George, it's 6 years behind schedule, $163 billion over budget. How do you get $163 billion over budget and not get a slap on the wrist, George?
Somebody's lining their pockets, Michael.
Yep.
Something's happening. And let me ask you this. With this kind of technology that you say we haven't used in warfare, we've got it for something big if it happens, what do you think its capability might be? I mean, we've got everything you really need to fight a great war, and I don't mean great in terms of its good, but I mean the size. What would this kind of technology do that we don't have publicly?
Well, I think we have used it in wartime, George, in some cases. We definitely have reports of a glowing object moving very fast over Desert Storm 2 battlefield. We got that from a pilot report, F-18 pilot report on that. So it's a dead solid report. Oh, I definitely believe they're using it. But in some cases, it became too expensive and they stopped using it, quote unquote.
But what would it do? Unless it's some kind of technology that is way out there, like some particle beam or something like that, what would it be used for?
Well, let me give you a quick example. When the B-2 stealth bomber rolled out November 22, 1988, in Palmdale Air Force Plant 42, the Northrop facility, it had been rumored for years, George, that there was a subscale prototype manned craft that came prior to the B-2. Now, recently got basically confirmation that that's true. According to the Bill Scott reports, there was a pilot who was also a UPS driver who was driving north on Highway 375, so he's heading northbound, and then coming southbound toward him, he sees this flying wing configuration that's on the deck, George, approaching him at high speed. He is so low that when he passes over the UPS truck, it has this compression wave and presses down on the UPS truck, and all this dust comes flying up into the air. This guy pulls off to the side of the road, jumps out of the UPS truck, and looks back at him over his left shoulder just as soon as this aircraft goes under the vertical and peels off to the left. He said, George, that it looked like the B-2, but it wasn't the B-2. It was something else. It had a different triangle trailing edge. So what I'm saying is that the $22.4 billion procurement funding that was poured into the B-2 program by first rollout November 22, 1988, Northrop could have easily funded multiple other black programs within that procurement funding.
But, I mean, do you think this thing unloads 10,000 troops at a time and delivers it to certain battlefields? Or?
Not in this program. Maybe in another program, but not in this particular program. Again, we have to go back to what Ben, if we take Ben Rich's statement at face value, basically just weeks prior to his passing, he said that we have things that are 50 years beyond what you can comprehend, not what you know or think.
Well, and I believe him. I don't think the guy's lying, is he?
I don't think so either. Even Jim Goodall doesn't think so either. So we've got the beginnings of a secret, classified secret space program. And even today, George, the original sighting by Chris Gibson on that offshore drilling platform, August 1989, when he saw the KC-135 and the two F-111s flanked on the left-hand side, the KC-135 was trailing some type of a black isosceles triangle right in back of the boomer. So that case has not been explained. So we've got multiple different aircraft out there. Some of them have been confused and are being counted twice in some cases. But at the very least, George, and I have it on very good authority, and you can take this to the bank. When you hear about X planes, George, you hear about the X-47 or the X-51, George, we have twice as many X planes as being publicly reported.
That's crazy. Let's go to our first-time caller, Guzman in Arizona. Welcome to the program, Guzman.
How's it going, George?
Good. Thank you.
Good to talk to you, Michael. I'll background real quick, give it some context, and try to move through my story. I'm a supervisor in federal law enforcement in the southern Arizona desert. I grew up in Kansas in the flight path of McConnell Air Force Base. I know military aircraft on the ground and in the air.
Right.
June 12, 2008, I am directly south of the Barry M. Goldwater bombing range. In a large Indian reservation, and a low ohm like frequency noise starts to vibrate my truck. I'm stopped, and so I get out of the truck and I look up, and there's fighters overhead. There's constantly air traffic around the Barry M. Goldwater bombing range, and I notice the distinct sound of the aircraft. They're FA-18 Hornets. There's none stationed in Arizona. There's no reason for them to be there. They don't train there. They don't fly there. They're not there. Well, as I'm watching these fighters overhead, realizing what they are, I can just almost imperceptibly detect that the sky is moving. So I reach into my truck and I pull out my night vision and I turn it on and I look up, and above me, as witnessed by another supervisor that was parked directly next to me, there was a portion of the sky that's so large, I almost can't put into words how large the section of sky that was moving was. And so I followed it, with my MBGs. I was able to actually find the outer edge of this craft. And it was, I say craft because we don't know what it was, but the reason I called is you talked about the star projection where they're projecting what's above them. And it was, I could plainly see in my night vision that it was a craft. But the immense size of this thing, I almost can't put into words. And it had an escort of six F-18s.
Mm-hmm.
Do they normally have escorts, Michael?
In some cases they do, George. Let me hit you with a statement made by Colonel Elton Whitley. He was the F-117 first U.S. Air Force pilot to fly the aircraft. Here's what he says. He says, Lord knows how many other secret government projects were tucked away in that remote corners of the huge test range, the Nevada test site, the size of Switzerland, but we figured we were far from alone out there. So he knew that there were other programs going on beside the Skunk Works. Northrop has their own Skunk Works. Even McDonnell Douglas had their own Skunk Works as well.
So much going on. So much. Let's go next to Frank in Hollywood, Maryland. Hey, Frank, go ahead.
Howdy, George. Glad to be back with you. A couple of things.
Mm-hmm.
That triangular object that we saw a couple of months ago when Linda Moulton Howe was on the show, a first-time caller called in, and she described that triangular craft to a T.
Yep.
And I saw it. That was, well, actually not my first UFO experience, but the second thing is these red, blue, and green flashing lights on some of these crafts. I think that's ours. Why would an extraterrestrial craft have these same sequence of lights? They might not even have blue and green where they come from. And the third thing is, can you get in trouble by guessing at something, if the government says a certain project doesn't exist and you guess upon it, can you get in trouble? Like if you say the United States has an earthquake machine, and clearly they don't, but could you get in trouble by guessing at something?
You being the citizens?
Yeah.
I don't think you can. I don't think you can get in trouble if you guess something and you hit it. At all. Michael, you agree?
I agree, George. Remember, they don't care what you know, they care what you can prove.
Well, that's absolutely true. And unless something is identified, you got to call it a UFO, right?
Right.
Don't necessarily say that it's from out of this world. Daniel is calling from an anonymous place. Go ahead, Daniel.
Hi. I'm glad your caller before last identified those F-18s. They came out of Yuma, Arizona, Marine Corps Air Base that the Navy does flights. And that craft that man saw was directed from a small Air Force base. And I'm glad you touched, Michael, on there were many skunk works.
Yes.
Boeing Military Aircraft Corporation, bought McDonnell Douglas in the 80s. And they took over their operations where you're at, George, in St. Louis.
Uh-huh, that's right.
And I can tell you this. People that worked on this craft are all around this area. And we were we signed security agreements that were higher than working on Air Force One. We did Air Force One and Air Force Two here. And I'm talking about McConnell Air Force Base. We were a B-52 bomber base. We were a KC-135 and the new KC base. BOMAC at the time had a hangar that held 4 747s. The first one to leave was Maiden of the Sea that was brought down over Lockerbie Scott. In 1986, I'd been there on the flight line for approximately 8 years. They completely shut down the North Hangar.
Now, when you say shut down, Daniel, they shut it down for security purposes?
No, for commercial.
Okay.
And there was no more 747 stored in there.
Hold on. Did they move it somewhere else?
I don't know where they took them. What they did was, I don't know how much Michael knows about the satellite skunk works.
And what was that?
That was coming out of Wright-Patterson. That was coming out of the bases in California that went to these, we're in the middle of the country. And I guess they considered we were pretty secure since we had done the Air Force One and Air Force Two here. We had merged, BOMAC had merged with other major aerospace corporations.
And I guess when you mean satellite, we're not talking about satellites in space, but satellite branches all over the place. Like you've said, Michael, they do scatter it around, don't they?
Sure. They move it from place to place. Yep.
They do indeed. Michael, we're almost out of time. Okay. Again, very quickly, 30 seconds, mention your crossword puzzle.
Sure. I've got two crossword puzzles.
One is my Ben Rich F-117A Stealth Fighter crossword puzzle. It's kind of a final completion of 25 years of research into black programs. Lockheed Skunk Works, HAVBLUE, F-117, all put together in one. And there's a $1,000 cash prize for anyone who can correctly solve this puzzle by 11:59 p.m. this Sunday. And then the other puzzle, another $1,000 cash prize for anyone who can correctly solve my Northrop D-2 stealth bomber crossword puzzle by 11:59 p.m. this Sunday.
And the link is right under your name at coasttocoastam.com. Up next, Supernatural Beasts on Coast to Coast AM.